This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 217. Today, we sat down with Donna Malieri from the Azure Functions team to talk all about Azure Functions, recorded live September the 25th, 2017.
Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Microsoft Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, and the competitive landscape and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
Send us a tweet, either to the show at MS Cloud Show, or to Andrew at Andrew Connell.
Or Chris at LoungeFlyZ.
As we'd love to connect with you. We're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself, though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery, from individual items to entire team sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com. Hey everyone, we got another episode here from the Ignite 2017 conference. Today I sat down with Donna Malieri to catch up on what the latest stuff was about the Azure Functions. Now in the episode I did reference that this was the first time we talked to someone about Azure Functions, but we actually had Chris Anderson on the show with Jeremy Thake a while ago. A lot of stuff though has changed with Azure Functions, and so we wanted to catch up on what the latest stuff was, including all the great announcements and good stuff to share straight from Orlando and the Ignite 2017 conference. So with that, I'm going to just transition straight into the interview. We're going to have a great, very high energy discussion all about what Azure Functions are all about. So take it away, Donna.
ShareGate makes it easier for organizations to adopt and use the latest Microsoft productivity tools, helping millions of users be happier and more productive at work. ShareGate is trusted by over 10,000 IT admins from over 110 countries to manage, migrate, and secure their SharePoint and Office 5 environments. ShareGate is recognized as the must-have tool for day-to-day administration of on-premises, cloud, and hybrid environments. Interested in learning more? Check us out at ShareGate.com to learn how ShareGate can make you more productive.
What if you could take any process your teams use to get work done and make it happen automatically? What if you could save countless hours and help people work better together? Nintex can make that happen. With the Nintex platform, work flows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back, and it flows in and out of the tools that you use every day. With Nintex, work flows so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever.
All right, this is Andrew here. I'm here again. Today, we're doing another one of our Ignite shorts, and we're talking about Azure Functions. I'm here with Donna Malieri, is that correct?
Yep.
All right, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself first instead of me trying to get names right?
Actually, you pronounce my name right, and most people don't. So yes, I'm Donna Malieri. I'm a program manager on the Azure Functions team. My focus on the team is the developer experience. So that's the tooling, that's the portal, application insights integration, that kind of thing. And you can follow me on Twitter at Lindy Donna.
Lindy Donna. Okay, sweet. And that's how we met up. I guess there was a little bit of stuff that was going back and forth on Twitter.
In fact, somebody was like, oh, Donna would be great on the show. I'm like, I don't know what the show is, but I'd love to do it. And of course, I was telling Andrew earlier, it's because I don't listen to any podcasts. I like to read. So I used to be an academic, so I'm used to reading a lot of research papers. And so videos and podcasts just seem so slow in comparison.
Thankfully, we have, I feel the same way. When I'm listening to any books or anything that's like for pleasure, I like to read.
Yes.
Like for any of the, I always get it mixed up. What was it, the nonfiction?
Yeah.
Anything that is like more like business or any kind of like history and like that, I'm always on Audible and then listen to the podcast, and thank God they give you like the, you know, the 1X, the 2, or the 1.5, the 2.5 or whatever speed.
Absolutely, those are great.
Yeah, so when we met up, and I realized last week on Twitter, and we've been wanting to find the right person to put on the show or get on the show to talk about Azure Functions, which, I mean, it's just like wildfire right now inside Azure. It's one of the coolest things going. We haven't had anybody on the show that has actually talked about. We've talked about it a little bit on the peripheral a couple times, and we've had some people talk about some tools that they built for Azure Functions. But I thought we'd have a discussion for our listeners on, you know, what are Azure Functions, and then, you know, what's new this week at Ignite for around Functions. So I guess to start off, I mean, if you would just share with us, like, what would you say are Azure Functions, like the 101 for what people are trying to get into?
Sure. So Azure Functions is serverless, and let me explain what that means. First off, don't be put off by the name. When I first heard it, I thought it was a little little silly because obviously there are servers. But the way to think of it is that it's like wireless. In wireless, Wi-Fi, for instance, there are obviously wires in the router. But as a user, you don't actually use wires. So as a user, the experience is wireless. The same way when you use Functions or any of the other similar products that are serverless, you're not thinking about servers. You're just thinking about your code. So what serverless means is it's usually three different things. First is abstraction of servers, meaning you can't log into your server. You have no idea how many what's actually being provisioned under the covers. You don't directly control how much compute you have. The next thing is that it's event-driven, and it scales based on events. And so that kind of ties into the first one. So instead of saying, I want five servers, you say, I have this event stream. And the system will look to see how fast your code is processing events. And if it's processing them more slowly than the rate of incoming events, it adds more compute. And then as it slows down, it will scale back your compute. And then the third part is that it's micro-billing. In other words, you pay per execution. So let's say you have a function that needs to run once a day at 10 a.m. It's going to send out an email report. So you pay for that one execution once a day. You don't have to pay for availability because, you know, in the cloud, a lot of vendors will say, hey, we have per second billing or even microsecond billing. And you're like, okay, great. This is awesome, right? Mm-hmm. Except you have to pay for availability with traditional compute. Mm-hmm. So if your website needs to be up the whole month and it gets one hit in that month, you're paying the whole month.
Right.
So with serverless, you don't have to think about utilization and capacity. And so in addition to things like app service, which gives you the freedom from thinking about the operating system and frameworks, you get an even higher level of abstraction. In fact, in my opinion, serverless is really delivering on the promise of cloud that they told us about back, you know, 10 years ago when the cloud started.
Yeah.
They said, oh, you're gonna write code and it's just gonna go on all these machines and it'll be awesome. And
then, now you have to worry about these virtual machines.
Exactly. And then they gave us VMs. That's what they told us. And then they gave us VMs. Yeah. And then they gave us PaaS, which is great with app service and things like that. But now this is taking it one step further. Mm. Now, serverless is not a magic bullet. It's not a silver bullet. It's not the best solution for everything. The best things that fit the serverless model are solutions that are naturally event-based in nature. So HTTP is an example. Timer is an example. Queues are an example. Let's say you have a website, a traditional website that you stay with whatever technology you're using. Customer places an order, you put it into a queue. Azure Functions can process that queue. Mm. So you can adopt it slowly. You don't need to rewrite your entire solution to take advantage of this.
I see. That's really cool. And I know that one of the things that when I first got into, I was a little confused by the whole notion of how I had to have like almost reserved instances or app service versus running as a consumption model.
Yes.
I've done a bad job explaining that for some people. So would you get
So this is a thing that we definitely should talk about more because it's one of the unique things with Azure. None of the other serverless offerings have that. So Azure Functions technically is functions as a service, and you can either run it in a serverless model with something called the consumption plan, and that's the plan that works the way I talked. Mm-hmm. So you pay per execution, you don't reserve capacity. Now, Functions is actually built on app service. It's the same team. And the underlying infrastructure is the same. And what we heard from customers is that sometimes they want to have dedicated compute, either because of latency or they want some of the extra features you get with dedicated. Like, for instance, you can connect securely on-premise with the dedicated compute. And also, if you're using 100% capacity of your compute and you know your load, it can actually be cheaper to have a reserved instance. The other reason that we have an app service plan offering is that you can go even further. If you want to use an app service environment, which is basically an entire version of app service on all your own machines, including your own front ends, then you can run functions on there as well. So about 75% of our customers use the serverless plan, 25% use an app service plan. Oh, and there's one other reason to use an app service plan. If you have a web app that's not getting a lot of traffic, you can just use that spare capacity on a function.
Oh, I see. Okay. And I guess, I don't think the use case that I hit that I needed to do it was that I was using it to host a bunch of webhooks, and I started getting issues from some of the people that were sending me webhooks where they had a really low limit on the response time.
Yep.
And so, correct me if I'm wrong, but is it with consumption? Let me finish that statement. The reason I went to the more app service model was because
I needed the immediate response
right.
and not the kind of warm up. Where my understanding with consumption is that the one of the reasons you're able to deliver such a flexible pricing model or a very friendly pricing model is that when a request comes in, then Azure is going to find where are spare cycles available or where is spare capacity available, and then it'll allocate my yes. function in that spot and go run it, which that may take a couple seconds to get done.
Yes. Basically, that's what we called cold start. So right. when your function goes idle, if it's been idle for more than 20 minutes, then it will go idle, and then you'll have a cold start. And there's three components to cold start. First, it's actually provisioning the compute, and then it's the time for the host to start up, which is our function's runtime, and then it's the time for your code to start. So if you're doing a bunch of code, like a bunch of stuff in your code, like installing NPM packages, which some people are doing, you're going to have a really bad cold start. So we control those first two. Obviously, you control the third one. Now, cold start is a really hard thing to get right because there's a trade-off between capacity that we're managing, keeping our costs low, and responsiveness for you. So other vendors have also struggled with this. Over time, when they first came out, they had much higher cold start than now. This is something we're actively working on. So we are doing experiments now where we're seeing cold start go from 5 seconds to less than 1 second.
Oh, wow.
So for scenarios like webhooks, that'll be much better. Of course, we want to go further and really support webhooks. The other thing that's really important to note with cold start is that you don't always have to do your webhook processing in the request itself. So you could use the webhook to actually trigger the flow and then use a queue message to actually do the work. So that's kind of the async webhook scenario. Mm-hmm. And so you can do that manually just by doing a queue output. I do that in all my samples, actually, yeah. because it's I have a very simple, lightweight HTTP front end that's just JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And instead of it creating a queue message, it just calls an HTTP endpoint. That HTTP endpoint creates the queue message. Now, if you're ambitious, you can also use a new preview feature we have called Durable Functions, where we have built-in support for the async HTTP pattern, where we'll actually return the location that you can use to query whether or not the work is actually completed.
Ah, okay.
So this is actually compatible with how Logic Apps uses HTTP. So if you want to use the two together, you can. So that's called Durable Functions.
So that's one of those, I think I saw something maybe a month ago, maybe a little bit beyond. Maybe
yes,
a little
that's about right.
Where you guys had like a white paper that went out and you talked about like four or five different patterns.
Yes,
and
that's it.
So that was, okay.
That was one of them. Another one is a function calling another function. Mm. And so that's sort of similar to what I'm talking about here, but let's say you want to chain multiple functions, or let's say you want to do fan out and fan in. You want to do kind of a MapReduce style.
Right.
And that's where durable functions really shine. Now, durable functions is a lot more advanced. So, once you're more familiar with functions is where you want to use that.
I see. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, in the little bit of time that I spent with them,
yes.
them, it's really nice to be able to spin something up so quickly.
Absolutely.
Without having to go worry about so much like the provisioning and
Absolutely.
All that kind of stuff that's got to be done.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you a little bit about the developer story or the
yeah.
development story. So my understanding is today, if you're on the a Windows developer, I shouldn't say that. You can go straight to the website.
Yes.
You can go create a new function. You can do all your editing right inside the browser.
Exactly.
Right. If I want to do anything local, if I want to try and build things, or at least if I want to build and test my function locally, mm-hmm. what does that story look like today?
Okay. So actually, this is a place where we really shine. We actually have the best experience on the market today. None of our competitors even come close to this. So what we have is something called the Azure Functions Core Tools, and that's a CLI interface along with the script runtime. We call it the function script runtime, and that's the same runtime that runs in Azure. It's literally the exact same bits. Now, some things run slightly differently, and you don't get the scale-out logic because
sure.
that's part of the fabric, but it's very high fidelity. All of our devs use it for their testing locally, and you get basically a very, very high fidelity inner loop experience. The other thing that you can do that's super unique compared to every other vendor is that you don't have to mock your data. So let's say you want to trigger off of a new queue message. That can be a queue that's actually in Azure. And then you can write back to Azure storage in your function. So you get something called hybrid debugging, where you're setting a breakpoint, a new queue message comes in, your breakpoint triggers, which means you get to test your application, like pieces of your application, especially if you're using a microservices model. Super valuable.
Yeah.
Now, what we've announced this week, which everyone's really excited about, is we have a preview version of the core tools running on .NET Core, which means you can run it on a Mac or Linux. It doesn't have all the features. Before you get too excited, it doesn't have all the features yet,
yeah.
but it's coming. We're working on this. We plan to complete this and ship this hopefully within very soon, probably within the next 6 months would be my guess.
Oh, cool.
We're working on it fast. In fact, if you go look at our repo, the dev branch is now the core branch. So
okay.
that's the branch that we're working off of. And we've ported everything. Now, not all the features are there yet. This is partly because we are using some underlying SDKs that haven't yet been ported to core, but we're working with teams to do that.
Gotcha.
So now, basically, all of my samples that I've had so far, I have them working on .NET Core. I have a demo later this week, which I'll be doing completely on a Mac. So basically, instead of Visual Studio, you'll use VS Code, which VS Code is great. Visual Studio is obviously the best debugger in the world.
Sure.
But VS Code is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
So you'll get that full dev experience that you get, and you can run JavaScript functions or .NET functions and use VS Code's debugger, and it all works beautifully.
.NET being .NET Core functions.
Absolutely. That's .NET Core functions. So what you will do is when you create a class library, right now if you create a class library in Visual Studio, a functions project, it'll create a class library that's the new project type, but the target framework will be .NET 4.6.1. That's the current functions that's out there. Mm-hmm. If you go change that target framework in your CS proj file, you have to manually edit it. Mm-hmm. Change that to .NET Standard 2.0, mm-hmm. And then change your references and your code, of course, so you're not using anything that's not in .NET Standard 2.0. Now you can target, you can run this on a Mac or Linux. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we're planning to have feature parity where it makes sense for all of our bindings and triggers and all of the features. In fact, most of the time, we're going to have better features in core, like logging, for instance. We're going to use the same ASP.NET Core logging primitives, so you can use the same config that you're used to. You automatically get debug output for the ASP.NET web listener, so you get much richer telemetry. So overall, it's just going to be a much nicer experience.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, that was. So I'm a Mac developer. I'm on a Mac, and that's what I use for my developer experience, right? And so I'm all like Node, I'm all JavaScript and everything. And seeing like .NET Core, I'm an old school Windows guy,
yep.
or old school Visual Studio and C# guy. And so when seeing .NET Core, much more interesting. And then I saw an emulator come out that was Windows only. I was like, Mac thing. So I didn't know that the .NET Core was coming out.
So that's awesome. People have asked, they're like, wait a minute, why did you, we came out with this new product, this product has been out for less than a year, why didn't you target .NET Core to start with? That's a very good question. We have a very good answer. So Azure Functions is built on an older technology called Azure Web Jobs. And Azure Web Jobs, when it came out, .NET Core did not even exist, not even .NET Core 1.0.
Yeah.
There's no such thing.
Yeah.
So what we did, it was a lot of work for us to port it, because we first ported Web Jobs from from full framework to .NET Core. We had it rip out System Web, replace that with ASP.NET. Figure out all the incompatibilities. We had limited use of app domains. We had to transfer that over. So it was a lot of work. This was something that was always on our roadmap from the very beginning, but it was a lot of engineering work. And until Core 2.0 came out, it was really not very feasible, because they've added, I can't remember, I think it's 20,000 APIs in between the .NET Core 1x and 2.0. And so the experience was actually really smooth. It only took us a few months once we had those latest bits.
Oh, that's nice.
And so now, along with this, you can use it in Azure as well, in a preview basis. If you go into the portal, there's an app setting called Functions Extension Version. Mm-hmm. In the podcast, I'll link to a blog post that has all the notes of how to do this.
Okay.
But if you change that value, it'll say tilde 1 by default, meaning that you're on a 1.0 runtime. Mm-hmm. If you change that value to beta, you'll be on the 2.0 runtime. And so you'll see different templates. Right now, there's some of them are missing because we're porting them over to 2.0. In the fullness of time, that's where all the new features are going. So we're backporting features to 1.0 if they're bugs, but our new feature work is going to 2.0. Now, there can be breaking changes between 1.0 and 2.0. So that's why, obviously, we're trying to minimize those. Those are mainly around things like HTTP, because it's a completely different stack. Mm. But queues and things like that should all work very similarly.
Gotcha. That's very cool. So okay, and so when I want to kick a function off, when I want to start it, there's a bunch of different ways that I can do that with different triggers,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yes.
And so I know that some of the triggers that you guys support today are HTTP triggers, stuff that goes really all the storage stuff, so tables, queues, and blobs.
Yes. Tables is not a trigger; it's an input binding, and I'll explain the difference. But go on.
No. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So this is actually another place where functions is unique. So every single serverless platform has triggers, because that's where how you actually schedule your code. Mm. What functions has is also input and output bindings. And this is also a unique offering. So triggers in functions always come with data. So if you have a blob trigger, you get the blob that actually triggered the change. Even on a timer trigger, you get the timestamp, which will obviously be basically the current time.
Sure, yeah.
And then you also have something called an input binding. An input binding can use a binding expression, and it can have data that's in the trigger. So let me give you an example. Let's say you have a queue message that points to a blob in this JSON payload. You can use a binding expression. You say, this queue message has a blob ID parameter, and you use that by defining a POCO in C Sharp or using a JSON, just the JSON property in JavaScript. And now you have an input binding. So you have a queue trigger that points to other data that your function then gets. So the function hydrates everything. So your function code has no reference to any of these Azure services. So it's super easy to unit test and debug. Yeah. And I have samples where I've done this and I can show you. So before we had a Cosmos DB trigger, for instance, I was doing this with a queue message and it would point to a blob and it would point to a Cosmos DB document. Of course, now, one of our new triggers that I know you asked me about or before this was the Cosmos DB trigger. So I demoed this earlier in Nat Friedman's general session. So folks should check out that demo if they want to see it in action. But what that means is whenever there's a change in a collection, you can basically listen for changes and your code can do something. So for example, let's say you have a flight collection and the gate changes on a flight, you can send a push notification to a customer and you can use functions for that. Now you get a bunch of changes coming in, functions will scale you out to multiple instances and you pay per execution.
Gotcha. And that kind of model too, I mean, do you still see that, is it a better approach, like architectural approach, that when, if you have a bunch of changes that are coming in, instead of the functions actually handling those changes, is it a better idea to have like a listener and throw them all into a queue and then have something else like working off
that's
the queue?
That's a good question. So for our Cosmos DB trigger, we actually do group them together. So if they're, I don't know the exact number of seconds what the heuristic is, but you will get a set of changes together.
Okay.
But it all depends on your workload. If you wanted to, you certainly could put them in a queue to batch process them.
Okay.
Certainly with Event Hub, that's a very common pattern. In fact, we strongly recommend for Event Hubs that you batch process messages. Okay. Because Event Hubs, you have a very high volume of changes. Mm-hmm. Cosmos is unlikely to have so many changes that you couldn't process them in a timely manner.
I see. Okay. So other ways of going through and firing off triggers now. There was something that I know Microsoft came out with, or Azure came out recently, was a event grid.
Yes.
So is that like the new way? I mean, aside from HTTP, would that be like the new way to really do all kinds of input coming in?
Yes. So Event Grid is a really amazing service. Like when I first heard about it and they were working on it internally, like we were so excited because it is not just another service. It's actually an infrastructure offering. It's kind of like infrastructure, I should say. It's kind of like Azure Resource Manager that's pervasive to all services.
Yeah.
So what it does is it is an event pub subsystem, and it can be any kind of event. So it can be services within Azure, for instance, like a new blob. So people who are using web jobs and functions may know that Azure blobs until Event Grid didn't have a change notification system. We were actually scanning for blob changes. So on the consumption plan, if you had your function app went idle, you had up to 8 minutes worth of latency in processing a new blob. So in that case, we recommended that customers use a queue trigger with a blob input binding. Now with Event Grid, blob storage supports change notifications. And the really cool thing, this is going into a lot of detail, but I love this part. The way that Event Grid actually works is that it's really easy for services to onboard. What they do is in their VMs, the VMs that actually host the service themselves, they pump data, multi-tenant data, into Event Grid. So it's really easy for services to onboard. Event Grid automatically handles which piece of data goes with which customer. So Event Grid does the pub sub. It basically has all of the events for all blobs of all customers. And then you say that this is for this particular storage account, this particular function, this is my event subscription, and it manages that for you.
It's something, I know we're gonna sit down with a guy later this week too and go really in depth.
Is it Dan?
Dan, yes.
Dan Rossanova, he's the one who explained all this to me. So he'll go even better.
We're gonna go deep. I think Wednesday or Thursday. We're gonna have a nice long discussion with him about what Event Grid is and everything. He's wanting to get into it. But it really seems to me. I guess I'm waiting for him to correct me on this one. But for now, I'm gonna be right. It really seems it helps you guys in the sense that it gets you out of the trigger business.
Absolutely. We love it.
We focus on the.
We're probably their biggest fans, and we're also the first service to onboard, like to actually make use of it. Well, us and Logic Apps together. Logic Apps are in the same building as us. We're really good friends.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were such fans of this because you're absolutely right. Customers have said, hey, we want to write custom triggers.
Yeah.
And we were like, we couldn't tell them why. We were like, no, we don't want it. So we were like, maybe later.
Yeah.
Because until Event Grid came out, we couldn't give them a good answer. With that, we can write custom triggers because if you think about it, we have a multi-tenant service that we call the Scale Controller. Hmm. That's the thing that on the serverless plan is listening for changes to events. And it's running our code that has like Event Grid trigger and Cosmos DB trigger and all that. We don't want customers giving us arbitrary code that runs in this multi-tenant service. That's like unsafe and we wouldn't do it.
Right.
But with Event Grid, it gives you the ability to have custom triggers.
Yeah, they're set up for that kind of an infrastructure.
Absolutely.
Where you guys are just like, no, just let me know when I need to start running.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, we love Dan. Dan's awesome.
So one of the other things that I wanted to ask you about was I turned this on one of my Azure Functions or on my Azure Functions just recently, and I absolutely love the what I'm seeing from it from the App Insights integration.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so this week that goes GA?
Yes. Okay. It just went GA. So we had it in preview for a while. Actually, it was one of the smoothest previews I've seen in any product in Microsoft.
Didn't feel preview.
Exactly. The only thing we were worried about was performance, but the performance worked really well. The App Insights SDK has features where, as a service that's pumping data into App Insights, you can control the granularity of the data. So the SDK knows the instance you're connecting to and how much data it wants to accept, because mm-hmm. you can say, well, I don't want to spend a lot of money, so don't give me too much data. And what happens is functions will actually send less data. It will aggregate metrics.
Is that the sampling bit that
yes,
it does?
Yes, exactly. Okay. That's the sampling. So that's one of like the most innovative features I really like from an architectural perspective. And then once you turn on App Insights, literally all you do is you put an app key in and you get all these metrics. You get rich querying. In fact, in Azure, we use the same underlying service as App Insights. We have basically our own custom version, but we have the same query language as App Insights. So if something goes wrong with the service, you better believe there's a customer writing a query.
Yeah.
There's an engineer writing a query to find out, you know, what's going on with the service. Like, I mean, obviously it's not secret data. It's like, you know, your function started, your function stopped, that
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
But we can see, oh, look, you know, we didn't schedule this correctly, or, you know, this worker went down, we need to reschedule it.
Yeah.
Thankfully, we haven't had any serious outages, but when there's a customer reported incident, like, hey, how come my function's not triggering? That's what we use to investigate. So that's why we can really say with confidence, this is something you can use to monitor your applications, because chances are what you're monitoring is smaller than the entire Azure Functions worldwide runtime.
Oh, sure, yeah. And I tell you the one thing too, I commend you guys on this piece because when I first saw that come out, and I was like, oh, you can add App Insights to your Azure Function. What I ended up doing is I went there and I added App Insights. I saw the announcement come out for it, and then I just said, all right, how do I do this? Let me just go create a new Azure Function. It's right there for you. Get right away. I'm like, okay, well, that's cool. It's like, well, how do I add it to my existing ones?
Yeah.
And all it was just adding a key to a new environment variable.
Yep.
And so it was like, that's it.
It's super smooth.
Starting with it just says, here's your, we'll go provision one for you provision App Insights for you and put the key in.
Yeah,
otherwise, if you have one, just put it in. There was no like checks to add. There was no other stuff. Just how do I link it up?
I was really happy with how.
The onboarding was really simple.
I was really happy with how that turned out. And we have a link in the overview page now. If we see that you have a key, we go and find the resource. We plan to have even deeper integration. Like if you could have the graphs, the App Insights graphs right in the Azure portal, that would be awesome.
Yeah, that'd be cool. That and like, because some of the stuff with App Insights doesn't really apply to what I'm getting from functions. Like I look at my functions and they're all like node-based. And so there's like two or three of the main graphs that you end up getting. Only one of them ever has any data in it, which I mean, it's fine.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay, well.
The other thing is that App Insights is currently based on requests and you have to do a little bit of work to correlate the work that happens for a specific request. Like think back to my queue example.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have an HTTP request that comes in and then you do queue processing.
Yeah.
Now that's the same logical request.
Right.
But right now you'd have to manually correlate those.
Yeah.
So one of the things we're working on is along with the App Insights team, we're partnering very closely with them, is to have a higher level notion of a request so that you can actually see like all the things that are going on there.
So you can see like a session.
Exactly.
That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have a request coming in, I have one function that has it coming in and it puts it on a queue that fires off another function like that, I could see that is one whole story.
Exactly. Now a lot of for web, that's what customers have been doing manually. They'll be use correlation IDs and it's not too painful. I mean, it's not painful at all, but you have to do it manually.
Yeah.
And we'll make that streamlined.
Okay.
But one of the other things that you can do is custom metrics. That's also super easy. Like, I had never done it before. And I had like a demo the next day, I think. And I started like furiously IMing my coworker. And I'm like, how do I do this? Give me a sample. And then he sent me the sample. And I'm like, well, no, but where's the code? And he's like, no, that's it. Like, this literally is like literally it's two lines. It's literally two lines of code. And I'm like, it's never been that easy for me like to do anything. So literally all you do is you set like the key, like for your client, your app into their, your telemetry client. And then you just send your custom metrics. The other awesome thing that I love is that you can send a JSON object as your payload. And then in your queries, you can turn that JSON object into a column, like a virtual column in your queries. So it's super powerful.
That's really cool. Yeah, and just the ability what App Insights gives you, just the query language and everything, to be able to go get to see the analytics of your data.
Absolutely.
Really, it makes things so much easier.
It's beautiful.
I came from a world of like using Google Analytics for a lot of that stuff. And just switching over to App Insights, like it's so much richer.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it's so much, and the data is so much more accessible.
Absolutely.
Especially in the tools they give you to go through into query instead of.
Absolutely. Yeah. Google Analytics is a great product, but it's mostly designed for managing audiences and users, like user behavior. So it's great for marketers, like, oh, what are customers doing? Are they coming back? App Insights is for developers. Like, you know, what's happening with this specific query, or what's my latency to my database?
Well, it's that, and what I like about it is that it's giving me the ability, I know we're going a little bit off topic here, but it's giving me the ability to, I can still do those same marketing-y kind of things.
Absolutely, yes.
In App Insights, it's just, it's not tailored for that off the bat,
exactly.
And I get more control over the queries, which.
Oh, no, you're totally right about that. Now, as we're talking about this, I'm remembering that I actually, just a couple weeks ago, sent an email to my team that manages our App Insights instrumentation for the Azure portal. And I said, hey, I want these kinds of behavioral queries. Yeah. Should we instrument with Google Analytics? And they're like, no.
We can do that.
We can just do that. Donna, we'll write the queries for you. Just tell us what you want. So it's just not baked in, because that's not usually what people use it for. But yeah, you can totally do that. And like I said, we use it internally. So we use something like App Insights for monitoring our infrastructure. But then our Azure portal implementation also uses Application Insights. So that's how we see our response times, if there's errors, that kind of thing.
Oh, that's awesome. Cool. Is there anything else? We covered a ton here. Is there anything else that's going on this week or that you'd want to share?
Yes, I do. So so I talked about cross-platform tooling. And along with the cross-platform tooling is a new language model. And we'll be onboarding more languages. But right now, we have Node.js on it. So if you use our current Node.js implementation, you saw that it had some limitations. We're using something called Edge.js that has a version of V8 built into it, and you can call it from C#. The problem with it, though, is that it does not support native modules, and we have to decide what version of Node we're going to support, since we're actually bundling that in there.
Oh, okay.
So you had to use like one of the 6.5.0, you had to use that exact version of Node, and you couldn't use native modules. So what we've done in our release today is that we've made a worker model that is out of proc. So we have one instance, one process that's the functions host, and that's the thing that's actually doing the triggers, and it's figuring out that there's work to do, and it's doing the input and output bindings. Then what it does is it connects over gRPC protobuf to another process on the same machine that has the same lifetime as the host process, and that's called the language worker. So right now we have a Node language worker. In the future we'll have others, and it's an open protocol. So if you wanted to write your own, you could. Some customers have asked for Go, and I said, hey, write your own Go language worker. And so that connects over gRPC to that language worker. And so now you can use whatever Node version you want. You can use native modules and so on. We're going to do the same thing with .NET. A lot of customers have noticed that if you're using like Newtonsoft JSON or Azure Storage, you have to use the same version of the DLLs that we use.
Right.
And that's because your code is running in the same process as us.
So you can't have a conflict on the version.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and of course, there's a big limitation. Yeah. So what we're going to do is we're also going to make .NET work out of proc as well, so that it'll be the same thing. There'll be a .NET process. You can have binding redirects. It's your own process. You can do whatever you want with it. Binding redirects, whatever you want. Triggers and bindings will continue to work. The programming model will be identical. The code will continue to work exactly the same as before, the same as the functions 2.0 code. And you'll get all those features that you're expecting.
Okay, that might be the part that blows my mind. This is what you all the new language thing. So I heard this a little bit of this yesterday in a pre-NDA thing of what was coming for Ignite, but the presenter didn't mention this. He didn't mention that you guys. I mean, to show the openness.
Yes.
You mentioned one thing that you kind of glazed over. I'm not sure if our listeners picked up on it, but gRPC.
Yes.
That's a Google technology.
It is Google.
Protobuf.
Absolutely.
That's what Google uses between their search engines and their index engine and their search servers and their index servers to do it. This blazingly fast.
Absolutely.
That is really cool.
We investigated a bunch. We investigated
Drift.
And yes, and there was another one whose name I can't remember. Yeah. We did some performance testing on a few of them.
Yeah, ProBuff.
And we found
gRPC blows it away.
And we found it was much, yeah, it had all the features we needed, and it was widely used, well supported. And so, I mean, who cares if it's vented by Google? Like, yeah. It's an open protocol, so, you know, that's what
there's
we
C# support for it.
Exactly.
Node support
that's why we
Go.
Yep, so we adopted it. I mean, the same way that Angular adopted TypeScript, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, we're all devs, and we care most about technology being cool.
Yeah. I mean, from a consumer of functions, I don't care how you guys implemented it.
Yes.
I want it to be fast.
Exactly.
So that decision shouldn't matter to me, but what it does kind of put across an impression is they're using the best stuff that's out there.
Yep.
And showing, I mean, again, we've talked about it a few times on our show, but it also shows a very different Microsoft.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. A while ago, like, we would have had to get legal approval.
Yeah.
Like, well, why are you using, well, what's the difference in performance between the two? Like, even 5 years ago, those would have been the kind of conversations. Here, you know, we told our director, this is what we're doing. And he said, okay, give me the technical reasons. What are the technical reasons? That's literally all he asked about.
Yeah.
He did not care about anything else. He wanted to know, you know, what can it do? What's the support for it?
Yeah.
That was it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So that's one of our another, so we had a cross-platform.
Yeah.
We had these language workers that you'll see in preview with JavaScript, with others coming soon.
Okay.
And then the third thing, it's a little different from the other two, is Office integration.
Mm.
And so for that, we've partnered very closely with the Office team. And now Office can be challenging to connect to because of AAD.
Right.
Now AAD is very, very powerful, but it's also very secure, mm-hmm. which means that you have to use it in a secure way.
Sure.
So that means that getting an identity of a user can be challenging. You need to make sure you have the right token, the token hasn't expired, that you can refresh the token,
right.
all those kinds of things. So our bindings make it super easy to connect to Office. So we have an AAD token binding, which makes it easy to take a token from a request and turn that into an object in your code that you can use with other requests. And then we also have triggers for working with Office. So, for instance, a new file is uploaded to Office 365, or there's a change to an Excel file in Office 365, you can bind to an Excel document, you can make changes, save that back, and it all works super smoothly.
Very cool.
Yes. And there's going to be demos of this later this week, so definitely, if you're at Ignite, check them out. If not, then they'll be online at the end of the week, and it's super exciting stuff.
Yeah, one of our we interviewed Yin Arenas from the Microsoft Graph team.
Yes.
We talked a little bit about this morning, and it's just just how easy that you guys have made it to do that whole kind of plumbing.
Absolutely.
Back and forth and stuff.
Yeah.
It can listen to the webhooks hooked up
Absolutely.
To some of the things that are published from it, and there's a part where she was saying how you can also, it also handles the subscriptions. How you have to renew your subscriptions
yes.
with it.
Yes, yes. So for performance reasons. An Office, like if you have an email webhook for something, whenever a new email comes in with this subject line, take this action, they need you to renew it every day to make sure you're still interested. Otherwise, you're going to be sending a bunch of events that no one cares about.
Yeah.
So one of the things we've done is that we have a timer that runs, I believe, every day that renews that webhook. Like, you maintain your interest in this subscription.
It's all done for you.
Exactly. Exactly.
This is so cool.
And I mean, because if you think about it, there's a ton of Office developers, right?
Oh, yeah.
And not all of them are using Azure. So we really want to make it easy to use Azure.
Well, I think that's where a lot of Office developers, that's my background primarily, is as an Office developer, as a SharePoint developer,
yep.
but really an Office 365. And it's, you see a lot of the people that I talk to they're starting to look to Azure a whole lot more.
Absolutely.
At least they have over the last year. And I think one of the easiest things to kind of jump into is pointing to functions. Like,
absolutely.
Because it's the easy place to go host your code in the cloud that is very accessible to Office 365. So.
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
And actually, before we even announced this integration, we had a bunch of SharePoint Office developers just do this on their own, and they wrote some libraries and stuff, and they were so excited. They're like, oh, I used to put this on a worker role, and I paid $200 a month, and now I pay $2 a month, and it's even easier to use. So, and you'll see more with this. I mean, we're going to make this integration even better. This is just the first start.
This is awesome. All right, I got to ask, is there more?
That's it for Ignite, but okay. We have more releases or more conferences. Microsoft releases tend to go along with conferences, so you'll expect definitely more the last half of this year.
Yeah.
And of course, everything that we do is open source. So our portal is open source, our functions runtime, the web jobs SDK, these Office bindings are also open source. So you can file issues on GitHub, you can go on Stack Overflow and ask questions. My engineering team has a competition on who gets the most Stack Overflow points, and they actually get upset at each other if someone gets an easy question. They're like, damn it, it was my week to answer questions. You got that easy question and you got all the points for it. And I'm like, it's okay, I'll upvote you. And they're like, I don't know, you don't understand.
That's a great problem to have.
Exactly. So our engineering team is super responsive. And if you want to follow us for product news, follow the Azure Functions handle on Twitter. We also have a YouTube channel. We do a monthly live webcast. So go to youtube.com/AzureFunctions and you can see the webcast. Usually it's me and my coworker Chris, and we're making fun of each other and getting live questions on Twitter. It's great.
Is that Chris Anderson?
Yes, it's Chris Anderson.
Okay, yeah, he has been on the show once before, yes. A long, long time ago, when you guys first came out.
Yeah, and the last show he wasn't on it, but he was backstage, so we spent a lot of time making fun of him. And he's like, I'm right here. So it's a lot of fun. Definitely tune in. It's a great team. It's one of my favorite teams to work on, honestly. And this product really is like taking off. Like Satya has mentioned Functions a lot. Like, everyone knows he's all about AI. Yeah. Like it's really the thing that he's hitting on. And he'll mention serverless as the way to do AI, which we are just thrilled about, honestly. And now that EventGrid is online, we get emails every week from Azure services that are like, hey, I've heard it's really easy to integrate with you now. Can I do it? How do I do it?
Yeah, go talk to EventGrid guys.
And then we're like, have you met Dan?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's a great place to be right now.
Oh, totally, totally.
Yeah, awesome. Well, hey, thank you very much for sitting down.
Oh, thank you. This was so fun.
I told you it was going to take 20, 25 minutes. We went a little bit longer than that.
Oh, I don't mind. This is super fun. I love talking about this stuff.
Cool. I can tell. It was a lot of fun. I hope our listeners got a lot out of this.
Yeah.
Donna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.